Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Good morning, Patty.
Good morning.
So, listeners, today Augie has taken the episode off, and I am joined once again by Dr. Patricia Sopcich. If you remember, she did an episode with us earlier about nonprofits and taxes, and I asked her back for this episode because her PhD is in human and organizational systems, which is, for us lay people who don't understand what that degree would be, it's about leadership, right? It's about leadership and organizations. Is that right, Patty?
Yes, it's really how people behave in organizations.
So great, because I don't know if you've noticed, but there's an election happening right now.
Really? Okay. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think you can get out of bed before somebody is saying something to you about the election. You're like, okay, leave me alone. I haven't even had coffee yet. And for Augie, who drinks 74,000 cups of coffee in a day, that can be painful. Mm. But I wanted to talk today a little bit about sort of the traits that people look for in leaders. And sort of how those traits feed into how you would pick someone in an election or in any other organization. Like if you're one of those people who gets to pick the group that you work with in your grad class or whatever, that can be not life or death, but it can be the difference between an A and a C in a class. So I was wondering what types of personality traits can voters look for?
Well, I'm going to say this a lot, but that depends. And it depends, I mean, and that is the answer of the day, because honestly, there is no one ideal or universal agreement on who is, was, or would be the best leader in any situation, and that includes the presidency. It depends, because sometimes the choices people make are unconscious as well as conscious. We sometimes make decisions based on who we think we know and also who we're comfortable with, someone we would want to have a beer with.
And can I just say,
yeah,
I've had beers with lots of people. I don't want any of those people to be president.
Okay.
And if you're listening, people who I love, you know, you don't need to be president. Come on now. That seems like a terrible way to pick. But anyway, there are other things I assume that go into it as well.
Absolutely. I mean, what's happened, what I've noticed is that we have started or more predominantly equated our political preferences and choices to sports teams. And this attitude that we must win at all costs.
And so that a winner and a loser.
Mm-hmm. It's a zero sum game. There's a winner and a loser. And so logic doesn't really play a lot in that kind of decision process. Another thing I've noticed is that sometimes we vote how our families vote. And, you know, I have to vote a certain way because if I don't, then my family's going to be really mad at me, or I'd go against the family tradition. And what I really dislike about this idea is that it really gives candidates a pass. In other words, if you always vote a certain way, then they don't have to earn your vote. And I think that's really sad that we're not, you know, asking our, you know, candidates to earn our vote instead of just handing it over because they're of a certain party. And there's also this idea of name recognition. You know, often people vote because the name is familiar. So incumbents have a great, you know, advantage. They benefit because they're known. And sometimes their name is known, but voters have no idea, you know, who they are and what they stand for, but they just recognize the name and they say, I'm going to vote for this person.
That goes to your point of they don't have to earn your vote. They're just known.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm pretty sure that if Beyonce ran for president, she would win.
Probably.
Because everybody in the world knows who Beyonce is. Like, if you don't know who Beyonce is, you really do live under a rock. Like, if my 80-year-old mother is like, oh, I like that new Beyonce song, I'm just saying.
Yeah. And that is a really, you know, not a very good premise to make a decision as important as voting, but it's very common, very, very common.
What do you think people look for in leaders?
Well, I'm going to go back to my caveat comment that depends. Okay.
I mean, so it really, we should just say that at the beginning of every sentence.
I think so, because I mean, if you talk to five different people, they would probably give you five different reasons why they pick their leaders. I mean, I've known people to say, I want someone to take care of me. I want someone to tell me what to do and tell me what to think. And that's how I'm most comfortable. Some people want consistency in their leaders. You know, if you walk the walk and talk the talk, then I'm gonna vote for you. Some people actually want a rebel, someone who can actually break up the systems. And, you know, and then on the other hand, some people want to maintain the status quo, they feel comfortable doing what's already and always been done a certain way. And then, of course, you have this combination of choices. And, you know, because it's really hard for someone to find all the qualities they're looking for in one person.
Is that true when companies hire CEOs as well? Are they trying to look for specific, like, do different companies, when they're hiring a CEO, are they looking for different specific traits? He's a killer. He's a compassionate tree hugger. He's a whatever. And it almost always, by the way, listeners, I'm using he deliberately because very few CEOs of major corporations are women, which is a topic we could talk about for hours, but not now. but is that same set of criteria used in the sort of corporate or real world circumstance of picking leaders for organizations?
Well, I would absolutely, and I think that we go back to that depends. And so, because what people say they want and what they actually hire are sometimes very different. And a lot of it depends on who's doing the hiring. Is it a committee? Does the committee have to answer to one person? It depends on what your company's doing. If you're really, really successful, you probably want to hire someone that's going to continue that success, someone who's not going to rock the boat. If you're failing, well, then maybe you're going to try something new. And we can never disregard that sometimes we hire someone that that's not going to be as good as us, so we can look better than them. Because there's ego. I mean, we're human, we have egos, and someone, you know, if you hire a superstar, then maybe your star isn't going to shine as brightly if that person comes on board. And so maybe you're going to choose someone who's not going to compete with you. So there's always this human factor that's part of this process that no one talks about a lot, but it plays a huge role and part in selection processes. Absolutely.
You said something really interesting there I'd like to follow up on, if that's, well, it's all interesting, but the one point that I'd like to follow up on, which is, if the company is going in a bad direction, you may hire someone completely different in order to sort of shake things, like what I call snow globing, right? You're going to grab the company, shake it up, and see what happens to it. So that seems to me like a voter behavior as well, right? Like, I don't like where this country is going and we're doing crazy things and I want to grab this country and snow globe it, shake it up and see what happens, which seems to be that we do that sometimes in elections, right? We're going along, and then all of a sudden we're like, no, we need to shake things up a little bit. We need to bring on the snow globe. So that's fascinating to me that what happens in corporate or in organizational hiring is similar to what happens in voter hiring, if you will, because that's basically what you're doing.
It is. It's
hiring. As a voter.
Yeah, and thinking about needs, I mean, you want someone who's going to work for you. I mean, they're hired. They're working for you. A lot of people don't look at the presidency like that, but many people do. It's like, what is this person going to do for me? How are they going to take care of the things that matter to me? And so they're, you know, hiring an employee. Absolutely.
So that's interesting, looking at the election as sort of an interview process.
Mm-hmm.
right? Is this a person who, if they were sitting across from the desk from you, would you hire them for the job of what you perceive the presidency to be about? Do you think that it's that generationalness? Wow. That your generation plays into, I just made up a word, I'm sorry, we do that here on this podcast, that your generation has an influence on what you look for trait wise?
Well, I think it does. I mean, it depends, of course, but yeah, I think you can't deny certain things about, you know, what someone knows at a certain age is going to be different than maybe 10 years later. It can be tied to specific age groups and generations, but then again, there's always, you know, situations where individuals that will vote very differently than the conventional wisdom would indicate. So, and then the other thing too, it's, I find interesting is our votes are private, right? We walk in that voting booth or sign that, you know, absentee ballot or whatever privately. I mean, that it's supposed to be a private act. And so, you know, some people may vote one way and then talk about it differently. I mean, exit polls have been wrong, right? And so, we need to think about that.
I know that there's pollster bias, right? You tell the pollster the thing you want the pollster, you think the pollster wants to hear.
Sometimes,
because humans like for other humans to like them. Mm-hmm. Like we generally speaking are social creatures and want to be liked. It's funny to me that you say that it's a private act. It's supposed to be a private act, but my parents go in the voting booth together, which I found out to my horror 2 days ago when I was talking to my mother. I was like, what? She said, no, we go in there together. I said, why? She said, oh, I don't know. We just, you know, do. And she said, we don't usually agree. I said, well, do you fuss in the voting in the booth? And she said, sometimes. And I said, okay. But it never even occurred to me, but in part because I am single and I'm an extraordinarily independent individual in that way, I would never even entertain somebody walking in the booth with me. But Augie takes Mac in the booth with him so that she can see the process. He wants her to see him vote because he wants her to get into the habit of saying, oh, well, we just go and vote. That's what we do. She told the polling ladies the last time they were there that if they had coffee and donuts, more people would come and vote more often.
And I agree with that.
He had to explain the one vote per person thing. But I was thinking about that and thinking if I could go back to my younger self and say, oh, vote this way instead of that way. But, you know, the me now is very different than the me when I was, I think I was 2019 when my first presidential, I can't remember, when my first presidential election rolled around. And go ahead.
What I was going to say is that, I mean, I'll just throw this in if we want to add it and we can leave it. But there's actually a famous quote that at one time was attributed to Winston Churchill, but I think it's been debunked. We don't know where it comes from, but it kind of speaks to that. And the quote is this. This is not my words. This is a quote. But if you're not liberal when you're 25, you have no heart. If you're not conservative by the time you're 35, you have no brain. So that's been floating around, I think, since I've heard, and I did some research on it, since about the late 1800s. So so this thought about, you know, your question about generational and do they vote a certain way. So I thought that was kind of interesting that this has been talked about and thought about for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. And so we're not the first people to think about this. So.
Yeah, well, and I'm assuming that part of that is that you, when you're young, you're generally, I'm just generalizing here, folks, so don't come for me.
Yeah.
When you're young, you're very emotional about fairness in the world and justice and those kinds of things. And sort of as you get older, you get more cynical is part of it. But also part of it, I think, is that you become more part of the system. You've gotten your education and now you're at a job and you've got kids and you've got healthcare and you've got a home to worry about. Right? Like you're more
established.
Yeah, thank you. You're more established. And so maybe that's, and it's funny that those equate to liberal and conservative, because I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I know that it's not your quote, but it is interesting to me, because what it speaks to is the sort of passion that you feel when you're very young, mm-hmm. that maybe as you get a little older, some of that passion sort of shifts. Or shifts directions because you focus it in different ways.
If you're 25 and you're not working yet, you're in graduate school and it sounds terrific. We want everyone to have healthcare. We want everyone to have, you have causes, but you're not really invested in terms of you haven't taken on a job. But when you start working and start paying taxes, you may shift your thinking. You may not. You may continue your path of equality and want to pursue the things that you were important to you. They may continue to be important. But I think that I always, I have nephews that when they were much younger, very, very, we want this, we want that. And now they're in their 30s and they're going, they take out 40% of my money for taxes. And so this, kind of reality. That? Yeah. Yeah. This right. reality kind of hits home.
And how do I want that spent? And how expensive is this thing that I dreamed that we could do? There's some real, there does, I think, come over time certain shifts. And then some things you believe passionately your entire life, and that's mm-hmm. great. And some things you don't engage with at all your mm-hmm. entire life, no matter what. Somebody's like, doesn't this drive you crazy? And you're like, not really. No, I'm over here eating a muffin. I just don't, that thing doesn't drive me crazy. So I guess it all depends on what drives you. It comes back to it depends. Everything yep. about this. So thinking about people's experience as leaders, and how we evaluate their experience in terms of politics, when we look at presidential or senator or gubernatorial experience, how should people be looking at that as far as like, how do they evaluate when you're thinking in terms of hiring these people, right? Because
right.
going back to our organization, going back to politics as the act of hiring someone to work mm-hmm. for you.
Right.
How should we be looking at, because on your resume, there's like your experience and then your education and then your experience. Mm-hmm. And your experience should be sort of the highlights of the best of, kind of.
One would hope so.
how do we do that for politicians?
Well, in some ways it's easy, not always, but it's easy because some people that are running for office have previous experiences, right? They've been at a lower level, they've had other offices. And so we actually can look at their record. We can look at, their previous actions, any legislation that they've, started, what they write about, what they talk about in public.
And all of that's going to be on their website probably, right?
Well, not all of it. What's interesting is that, it's like your resume. They put the things on there that are going to be the most appealing because, of course, we're human and not everything we do and say and litigate and write about is going to be universally liked or accepted. So it's picking and choosing. It's like writing a resume, the websites and such. But we also have, if they've been in office before, we have a voting record, right? And we can see, where, especially a senator, representative, where we really can see what they've done in the past, I think is always very interesting. And I always like the idea of, we can listen, to what people say and then see what they actually do and see if those are consistent. That's very, very interesting to me, is to watch and to see what people say they're going to do. And then what they actually do is sometimes very different. So if we're talking about people that are new candidates, they're a little harder to assess because there's not as much of information out there. What they put out there is what they want you to see because maybe they haven't held office, they haven't voted, they haven't written, they haven't legislated. So you know, they're a little harder to assess. And when we think about, you know, people new to the process, you know, and voters, you know, some voters may want a new person with fresh eyes. I mean, you know, we can talk all day about term limits. I have very strong feelings about that, not the place and time to say that, but some people want people with fresh eyes. Some people just may want a small change in the party position. You know, they just want to tweak. They don't want to like that snow globe it. They want to just tweak something. and they think the new person can help in that process. Some people do look at people's education and previous leadership experiences. You know, have they been, you know, some people come from a university background. Have they been a department chair? You know, what have they written about? So they have, you know, and where do they get educated? What is their degree in? So they have some ways of evaluating them. And the other thing too, is that, you know, we talk about new people, but it's really, really hard to kick out an incumbent. It is really hard to do that. That takes an extra bit of effort and change to do that because an incumbent already has name recognition and many people will walk on a voting booth and look at the list and go, oh, I know that name, that's who I'm gonna pick. And so the new person kind of doesn't have a chance in that situation.
Yeah, we've been harping here on the podcast about researching your ballot. Mm-hmm. Research your ballot before you go in, figure out who these people are. I like your idea that looking at their education and their and what their degree is in, but also like, did they work with student organizations? Did they work with nonprofits? Did they do whatever it was that they did before? Almost nobody, I think it, President Trump aside, almost no one runs for the presidency without having done some, in fact, I think he's the first, without having been elected to an office previous to that. But you might get a House member who's not run in a previous, and I'm not saying that House members are less than the president, please don't. If you're a House member and you listen to this, I love you too. It's not that so much as that's a 2-year position. And so a lot of people think that's an entryway into, right? Like I'm going to be a House member for a couple of years and I'm going to be, or a couple of terms and a senator for a couple of terms. And then I'm going to attempt the presidency if they have those goals. If not, I mean, some people have been in the House their entire career. But I agree with you that the incumbent is that not only do they have name recognition, they also have infrastructure, right? They have a staff that's used to doing this. They've run before. They know everybody in the district and they know where the hot spots are and the cold spots are, which a new person coming in struggles to know where the hot and cold spots are. They struggle with their infrastructure. And unless they have a lot of money, they struggle with getting their name out there. Although I think you're right that sometimes the desire to snow globe can really benefit a new person. Right?
It benefits. Absolutely. Sort of,
you know, I think that that's what happened to Eric Cantor and Dave Bratt in, in my district was, people were tired of Eric Cantor for whatever reason, and they wanted to shake it up. And they picked a professor from a local university to be their member of Congress. And that's fascinating to me. That's a fascinating sort of, they're like, well, he runs classes. How hard can it be? He could run the House of Representatives. You know, like, and I'm like, well, he's not going to be the one who does that. But anyway, I mean, like, that's not how seniority works. But but yeah, it was a fascinating election for that sort of guy who comes out of nowhere because people were wanting a change.
Yeah, I mean, that was the first election, I think, when I moved here from California was that one. And that was in my district as well. So that was really interesting to watch what I heard, because again, I was fairly new to, you know, Virginia and Virginia politics, but the word on the street was that people were mad that Eric Cantor kind of turned their back on them. This is what they, this is the word on the street. Again, anecdotal, not scientific. So I'm not saying
we don't have polls, folks.
We don't have polls.
If Eric Cantor's listening to this, we don't have polls. We're just
but it was just interesting to me to hear what people said. And there were a lot of people that were actively engaged in, you know, replacing Eric Cantor. And I mean, to the point where in my neighborhood, people knocked on doors and came out and talked to us about it. It was really interesting. I find that fascinating. I mean, if you can kind of step back and get all the emotion out of it, it's a fascinating topic in and of its own to watch how that happens. So yeah, I'm with you. You could talk all day on that.
And that particular instance, to go off on a small tangent, was, I think also people thought that he was much more looking to step into a bigger national role.
Mm-hmm, I think
and
so.
That sort of big for your boots kind of thing bothers people at the mm-hmm. local level, because absolutely. Again, they've hired you, right? So it's the kind of thing you were talking about with shining stars.
Mm-hmm.
I need you to shine, but I need you to shine your light on me, because
mm-hmm.
I'm your boss and yeah. I'm, you know, and when you shine your light on yourself, there's only so much light to go around and I'm standing in the darkness, right?
Like, hey,
so I can
yo.
See where that would annoy people.
Yeah. People get upset. So.
Yeah, that's an interesting, it comes back to what you were saying earlier about that sort of hiring somebody, but expecting them to do certain things, not for themselves, but for the greater good, either for the company or for the organization or for the study group or for the district or whoever. So do you think that people look for themselves in a leader, or do you think they look for the opposite of themselves in a leader? Because I'm going to just say, I should not be president of the United States. Despite what I tell Augie almost every week about wanting to be president of the United States, I probably shouldn't be, because I don't know that I am educated enough. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. So I'm looking for someone different than myself. So
yeah.
I'm not looking for somebody to have a beer with. I'm looking for someone who's more wonky and sort of knows a lot about the world, mm-hmm. about business and about trade and about foreign relations and all that stuff. I think I've got a fairly decent handle on the domestic stuff,
mm-hmm.
but that's half of the president's job, right?
Right,
that's,
right.
The other half is huge and not something I think I have. So I'm kind of looking for somebody different from me, but
mm-hmm.
what do you think?
Well, I think that's true. I think, again, it depends. You know, I would say that some people really, you know, feel good in their own skin and they're happy, but they know that they want to have someone different. Some people vote for someone different than them because they're not happy. They don't like their circumstances. And so they think that voting for someone different might help their situation, make them better. But, you know, I know people that feel like, you know, that they know everything. They're, you know, and they, you know, they're the, and so they, you know, pick candidates that believe exactly the same way they do. They think they're the smartest people in the room. And so they seek out candidates that have the same values and beliefs. And in that, there's always this comfort factor. You know, some people, again, we talked about the beer, but sometimes it's just comfort that, you know, we just, yeah, that person, you know, you know, one thing I do want to say is that I hear people talk about candidates, you know, because I'm interested in this, and I've heard the word nice. Oh, that person seems so nice. And what I want to just remind people is that nice isn't always good. So we need to kind of separate how someone comes across, you know, maybe in their ads or how they're promoted, but are their ideas and the way they move, you know, do things, is that really good? Is that the good that you want for your vote? And the extra thing that I think is so interesting, and we've talked about this before, is voter consistency. I am so fascinated by people that take a really strong stance in one area, you know, this is what I believe, and then they have a completely different perspective on something else. And so quite, you know, they're inconsistent, you know, in terms of who they want, you know, and to vote for, and then what they really believe. And I find that so interesting. That's an area that I would like to learn more about, is this idea of, you know, you have two very important issues and they're absolutely contrary to each other. So.
I have to admit that occasionally that's me. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of humans are like that. I think I have a very strong belief about this thing. Ooh, but I also have a very strong belief about this thing. Yeah. And you're like, well, how do those two things go together? They don't, but in my head they work.
Yeah.
But I think that what you said there about nice versus good, mm-hmm. that so rings true to me in terms of, I'm going to keep coming back to this because you've put this in my head now as this brilliant. Okay. So thank you. This idea of hiring, mm-hmm. like I've hired people and I've had people who came in who were nice, really nice. And I'm like, oh, they would be so nice to work with. But then I've had people who come in who are stiffer and maybe they're not as warm, but man, they're bona fides. And when I've hired those people, they've been really good at the job. So it doesn't necessarily mean mm-hmm. that somebody who gives you the warm fuzzy can be good at the job. Some people mm-hmm. who don't give you the warm fuzzy turn out to be some of the best people I've hired mm-hmm. because they were incredibly competent. They're incredibly smart and got the job done the way I needed it done. Mm-hmm. So I think that we're going to just keep, I'm going to keep coming back because now I'm obsessed with this idea.
Well, think about it. I mean, I have, you know, when I came to VCU, I mean, I met a lot of people and, you know, my theory is the first 6 months, don't trust anybody, right? Because I don't know who is just being nice and who is actually really, really good. And so I just kind of withhold judgment. I kind of assess and step back. And, you know, when you're new, you can be a little more objective. And I remember someone that I met that was really not very nice to me, right? And I was very offended and felt like, huh. And that person turned out to be one of my best people I've ever worked with and one of my best allies. And so you just don't know. It's the nice can be, anyone can be nice for a certain amount of time. I truly believe that. But at some point, you know, the real person comes through and then you go, holy crap, you know, this person did this and they treated someone like that. And that's not what I expected. And so it's a really interesting thing to think. And I can't take credit for that thought. It actually came from Adam Grant. He wrote a great book called Give and Take. And one of the things he talked about is this idea of between nice and good. And when I read that, I went, wow, that is, I mean, it really resonated with me to just think about that. It doesn't form all my decisions, but it does keep me, I notice it. I guess that's what I would say. I just notice it more than I did before.
Well, I'm going to liken it to something that some of our listeners will actually appreciate. Think Tinder. Right? Think dating apps where people present to you the person they want to present to you and they seem like a perfectly nice, perfectly wonderful person. And you go out on a date with them and they're a monster, right? Like that happens. And it is not an infrequent thing that happens.
Yeah.
Because people are able to present the image that they want to present for whatever length of time that it takes to sort of woo you. Mm-hmm. The one good thing about politicians that we do have term limits for our politicians. They're called elections. And I know that it's hard to oust an incumbent, but it's not impossible. Ask Lindsey Graham, who right now is in the fight for his political life in South Carolina, and who would have seen that coming?
Like, right.
So 2020 is the year of, because everything about 2020 makes me say that. Actually, everything about 2020 makes me curse, but we don't curse on this podcast.
No, we don't.
So I'm going to say, instead.
Okay.
So now I'm thinking about my local politicians and my local elections in terms of hiring. Do you think they're different than the sort of national and that kind of level? Or do you think they're similar?
Well, I mean, I think they're both. It depends. All the things we talked about for president, senator, governor still apply, but there is a much more personal aspect to these elections. And I mean, because a local candidate may live in your neighborhood. Their kids may go to school with your kids. You may see them at church. And so there is such a more personal aspect to this than a national election where you know you'll probably never meet a presidential candidate, maybe not even a gubernatorial or senatorial candidate, but city council or state representatives, they can be your neighbors. And so it's kind of like the, I think about the old, you know, olden days in the small town where, you know, you behaved yourself because, you know, everyone knew your family. And so if you did something bad, they were going to go back and tell your mom.
Yep.
And so this has kind of reminds me of that, where, you know, you got to watch your P's and Q's because these are your neighbors. You can't be out there doing crazy stuff and not get someone to notice or someone to, you know, it's possibly more likely going to come back to you in a local election than in a national election because of that very reason. I think some people don't remember that or think about that sometimes and the things they do. We've had some interesting things happen here in Virginia with some of our local candidates, but you know, and I think it also is really, it's a little harder to be mean or negative about local candidates because, you know, these are people that you may interact with, if not now, maybe in the future. A lot harder to, you know, walk back really bad, evil, awful, derogatory comments if it's someone you're going to run into in the grocery store. So choose wisely.
I was just going to ask you about that, actually. So thank you for going there. It seems to me that for the most part, now, that doesn't mean every election, because some elections can get pretty hostile going for House and Senate. But I agree with you that at the local level, that doesn't seem to be the case. There doesn't seem to be a huge amount of that person for city council. They smack puppies, you know, like they don't, you know, like we don't say that because you're right. You're going to run into Richmond only has a certain number of people and then cut down to the certain number of people who are in politics. And that's a relatively small number of people. So if you talk smack about somebody, that's going to eventually, you're going to eventually run into them somewhere. And then you're going to be face to face and you're going to be like, hey, and then you're like, so I saw your ad, you want to talk about it? And you're gonna be like, no, I want to die right now, thanks. Right, like,
yeah,
you have to think about that. You're right, at a very different level than you do if you're going to get to go off to Washington and pretty much not be around those people. Because while most of the representatives in Virginia probably live at home for the most part, that's not true of very many other states, right? If you're if you're from Ohio, you're probably living in Washington. You're probably not, or, you know, California, you're definitely living in Washington. You're not traveling back and forth that much. So you're right. You're not going to run into the people that you were rude about. But when you're talking about the, you know, the school board, that you're going to see that person at the PTA meeting.
Yep.
So keep that in mind, local people running for office. You might want to be careful about who you talk junk about if you're thinking that you might run into them at the grocery store, because then they're armed with a heavy cart.
Yep.
So that leads me to sort of leadership in groups, right? Sort of this idea of city council or the school board or people who have to work in a group situation. And again, I'm coming back to the sort of your hiring analogy. How do we figure out who works well in a group? Because I have struggled with that when I've been hiring, because contrary to what people believe, librarianship is not individual librarians yelling shh all the time, right? We have a lot of stuff that we work on in groups, that we work on collaboratively. How do you figure out who's good at that?
Well, it is hard. And, you know, because a lot of the decisions that are made in a city council or a school board are group decisions. I mean, you're one vote in a, you know, of 12, of 7, of 9, or whatever. So these, you know, so we're electing people to, you know, one of two things though, we go back to, it depends, because some people want those people to be feisty and to fight hard, and that's the hill they want to die on. And other people just want to say, let's just play nice in the sandbox. How do you figure out who's good at that? Well, if they've been in office before, that's one way. If you've interacted with them at a PTA meeting or some other group in a church setting, you know, then you have some idea about how they work. But it's an interesting thing. And, you know, when I think of hiring, so one of the tips that I give to people who are hiring and you want to find out how someone responds in a group setting is to give them behavioral questions. In other words, ask them about a time when they worked in a group and it was successful, and then ask them about a time they worked in a group and it was a failure, and see how they answer that. Because I will tell you, I've had some candidates in my lifetime that have said when everything failed, it was all their fault and it wasn't my fault. And I went, "Ooh, good information. Thank you for sharing." In other words, someone who perhaps maybe isn't willing to take responsibility, or if the project went really well, to say, well, it was only because of me that that project went really well. I mean, you're not going to be able to totally assess, you know, how someone responds in that setting, but you can get some clues. And then also when you check for references, especially if you're hiring, now that's different than a city council and a school board, but to really try and get some outside opinions to say, this is what I hear, this is what I see. And, you know, I want to find out if that's tracking and try and get some more information. So doing your homework is really important. And, you know, some people would say, well, you know, these aren't huge decisions, but I would disagree. I think they're all important decisions. We want to know, you know, we want to have a sense of how someone is going to respond in that setting. We sometimes like someone who disagrees. We want that feisty person. Other times, again, we just want to get work done. So let's just, you know, unless it's a hill you want to die on, let's just keep going. So it really, really depends. And it's so interesting. I think every person would have a different answer for that.
It seems to me like, and we're past the primary season, but it seems to me like the primaries with the debates are one way where you can see that. How does a person handle themselves in a group of that's hostile, right? Because theoretically, all those people are hostile to each other.
Right.
And how do you handle yourself versus how do you concede certain things? I'm going to concede that that's a good point. Like if politicians ever said that, I probably would fall over in a
faint. Oh, yeah. That you're not going to hear that very often.
Dead faint.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be amazing if in a debate you could say, you know what? I don't disagree with 3/4 of what you just said, but here's what I disagree with. Mm-hmm. And pull out the point and talk about a specific point, but give props to the person for saying 75% we agree on, right? Yeah. Like, because they do. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to find the nuance in a lot of those situations. It's not so hard when now they're from two different parties, like what we're seeing now with the debates. That's a little easier because they tend to be easier in some ways, harder in others because they're polarized. But
right.
But
yeah, I think your comment about the debates is really a good one, and that is a good space. It's one data point. It's a good place to kind of get a sense of that. But I always think about debates, especially now that they're all televised, as being kind of, you know, people are propping themselves up and trying to look presidential or senatorial or whatever they're trying to be. And so, you know, I don't know how much of that is their real persona or how much they're just pumped up to make sure they get their word in no matter what. So,
it's performance art.
Performance art. Yeah, absolutely.
But at the local levels, not so much. At the local levels, it is more about nuance and so that might be a way to separate those two things out. The other thing that strikes me about things like city councils and board of electors, you said it, and I'm going to repeat it because it bears repeating. Those positions decide your daily life. Like they are not inconsequential.
Right.
You need to know who these people are and you need to align them as much as you can with somebody who has similar beliefs about what you think needs to happen at the local level. you know, all politics is local, right? Tip O'Neill said mm-hmm. that, and it's absolutely true.
Absolutely true.
The zoning in your neighborhood is going to decide where a school goes, where an apartment building goes, where a shop goes. You know, all of that kind of the bike lanes that are now being put in Richmond. That's huge. And mm-hmm. that's new. And that's because this city council and the last couple of city councils have really cared about that issue. Mm-hmm. And in part, people who cycle have organized themselves and tried to push for candidates who wanted to have more safe cycling in Richmond, right? Like, that's a huge local public issue. Mm-hmm. A huge local public issue is, where do the buses go? We mm-hmm. just had a whole thing about whether the bus would go out to the registrar's office or not. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like a scandally sort of a thing here in Richmond. For those who are not living in Richmond, it was a big deal. And that decision is made at the local level. That decision is not made anywhere, not even at the gubernatorial level. Right. It's made at the city level. Mm-hmm. And so those elections are enormously, I would argue, they're in some ways more important to you than who the president is.
I would agree. I would agree you with know, you. Elections matter. I mean, no matter what level, they all matter. They do.
So see, and now you've heard it from an organizational expert, not just from a poli sci professor and from a librarian, well, a second librarian. Yeah. But you're now hearing it from all of us, like, you know, like, these elections matter, but all elections matter. Mm-hmm. The off elections matter. Like, mm-hmm. organize that drum as well. We're not electing a governor this year. We're electing a governor next year. Mm-hmm. That election is also going to be important, right?
Mm-hmm. The governor right. is important.
Yeah. Okay, so my sort of last sort of area of I wanted to ask you about mm-hmm. was the influence of other mm-hmm. forces on how you pick or how you choose a leader. Okay, so to take your hiring analogy, mm-hmm. I can ask to hire someone, but it has to go through the HR process, and there has to be sort of, the search has to be vetted, and I can't have just picked a friend, because that's not what we do in state government. We don't.
One would hope so, yes.
Right. I can't remember what that's called, but you're not yeah. supposed to do it. You're not supposed to do that, engage in that sort of behavior, right? You don't hire your buddy to be the lieutenant governor. Right? Well, here, you vote for that. But anyway, yeah. like, that's not how that works. Mm-hmm. There's a process by which somebody sort of checks and balances you. But also, before I go into the hiring process, the last time I did this, my boss sat down with me and we talked about what I was looking for. Like, she helped me sort of with guidance. Mm-hmm. She made suggestions about, well, maybe this, you should think about this kind of person or this kind of experience or this kind of whatever. And it was great because it was from a different perspective than my perspective. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm asking, what do you think the sort of the major, who are the major players in influencing how people pick, how people hire a politician?
Well, I mean, we talked about a lot of those in the, you know, before, but I mean, we all get our information, you know, so one thing we talked about a little bit before we did this was the influence of people that aren't, you know, politicians. So we are all heavily influenced by that, whether we admit it or not, that we are influenced. And so we have people that are, you know, in positions of perhaps power that aren't elected, that are influencing our decisions. And I can mention three of them, and there's a ton more. Obviously, our friends and our mother and everything else goes with that. And even our coworkers, I mean, they're influences as well. But I always think about the bureaucrats. You know, we talk about this hiring process. Bureaucrats are people that were hired to do a job, and oftentimes they are employed through several presidents. They have been on the job maybe for 30 years, so they've seen, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 presidents in that time. But they are there, and they're kind of running the show, steering the boat, and they have different levels of influence. Some of them are at very high levels. They head agencies. They're not elected. They're appointed. And some, you know, some have behaved badly in the past. We have evidence of that way back, you know, and I you know, not mentioning names, but back in the 70s, we had some bureaucrats that were behaving badly and that got caught. And that has gone forward. So
we're okay with mentioning Mr. Nixon's career.
Yeah. Okay. So bureaucrats, people that are appointed, have huge influence. And I think it's much more nuanced. I think it's much more behind the scenes. And I think sometimes we're influenced and we don't even realize it. It's very unconscious. So I think we have that to think about. Pastors, think about, you know, when you're associated with a church, pastors, I mean, they counsel people, they go up and do their sermons every week, and the things that they say may really impact how people vote, how people look at the world. I mean, it's a worldview that, you know, that could influence how you believe and how you think, you know, by going to church. You may not even realize it, but it may be something impacting you. And then the media, which is, you know, now the media is under the gun for some current activities that they've done in censorship. And they, you know, they have huge power. They have huge power because that's how we're getting our information. You know, whether we get it watching the news, reading the newspaper, watching television, going online, I mean, all the different ways we all, you know, we each have different ways we get information and news and weather or whatever, but how that's presented is really can influence you to a great degree. And one of the things that my husband and I talk about is what is not reported. It's always interesting to listen to someone report, and then you know that there's something else that, you know, that you read about somewhere else and it doesn't get mentioned. And you think, huh, why didn't they mention that? They were going down this list and they left out this one thing. And why did they do that? So I think we have to recognize that we are influenced by that as well, that we may, and maybe much more unconsciously than we think it is. So yeah, lots of interesting non-elected people. You talked about Beyonce. You said if Beyonce ran for president, she'd probably win. I don't doubt that, but that's kind of scary because What are her platforms? What does she believe? How is she going to govern? I don't know that. All I know is that I know her name and I like her and she's a good, you know, she's a great singer and she's beautiful and blah, blah, blah. And yeah. So
and she runs a business empire. So she does do that. Mm-hmm. But you're right. We don't know what her political, we know some of what her political stands are, but not at the level where you would actually hire somebody to be president. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that you talked about the bureaucrats as influencers, because I think that's really true. That whatever you may feel about the leadership of certain agencies, and right now I'm thinking the CDC, they are having an influence on the election.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they want to or not, whether they mean to or not, by sheer existence and by speaking publicly, they're having an influence. And of course, the media, the problem with the media is that we have a tendency to listen to people who agree with us. And we
Confirmation bias, absolutely.
Yes. And we have a tendency to ignore people who don't they're lunatics and they don't know anything, right? Like we have a tendency to do that because that's just a human function. And what we have to make ourselves do is listening to all sides. And in fact, I will take this moment to plug a website called All Sides, where they take an issue and they show you from the left, from the center, and from the right. And so you can look at the different views of that issue. Is it complete? No. But it's a pretty nice start at, hey, try to figure out what you don't know, because you're right. What you don't know is just as interesting and can be just as influential as what you do know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I just find it, again, fascinating. Again, if you can get away from the triggering and the emotional, you know, because we all are very emotional, we're very human, we react to what people say and what they do and how they act, you know, and we also, you know, we like certain, you know, newscasters or pundits, and they become celebrities, and that always is a problem, I think, when they start, you know, when it's more important for them to be a personality than to actually report the news. I think that gets a little dicey.
Oh my heck.
Yeah.
I completely agree. When they're on Twitter and Facebook and they have websites and they're selling themselves, I think back to my, okay, I now am entering my 800-year-old you kids get off my lawn moment for this podcast. So just so you know, I think back to Walter Cronkite. I don't think anybody knew anything about Walter Cronkite. I think people knew he was married because he wore a wedding ring.
Right.
But like, and they knew he was nearsighted because he wore glasses, but I don't think they knew anything else about Walter Cronkite because he was not the news. And in fact, he only became the news when he reported something about Vietnam, when he reported that the government was not being accurate in the numbers they were releasing about the deaths in Vietnam. And he regretted doing that later, as far as making himself the story, because he's like, I'm never supposed to be the story. It should never be,
right,
you know, who's standing there reporting. It should only be the facts.
Right.
And I find it fascinating that now about half the story is who's reporting it.
Right.
It's their opinion. It's their punditry. It's their whatever. Mm-hmm. And that I find distressing, because I think it's hard to find straight up news these days.
It really is. And it becomes, you know, kind of entertainment. And,
right.
And then, you know, you have, you know, everyone's got an opinion and they're not afraid to say it. And so you're hearing from all sides, and celebrities and newscasters and everyone. And so it's hard to feel like you're getting the whole story or the straight story from these people anymore. And that's really a shame, because, you know, we lose the opportunity to learn and to make better decisions because of that. And I think that's not in our favor, I don't think.
Well, and right now, when people are, for the most part, stuck at home, and they're stuck at home with their media, they're, as far as I can tell, not branching out to other, they're going down a deep rabbit hole of one side or another. They're not, right. You know what I mean? They're not combining those rabbit holes and ending up in a bunch of different places. They're kind of like, oh, I went to this site and they led me to this site and they led me to this site. And all of those are in the same arc of opinion.
Yeah. And when you're not, you know, interacting with people, I mean, I think, unfortunately, I love to talk politics, but I don't very much anymore, because it's such a hot, it's a trigger, and I don't want my mother yelling at me. I don't want to fight at the Thanksgiving table. I just, right. You know, I don't want to do that. And so we end up not having what you're trying to do here in civil discourse. That's what I really wish we could go back to, because I learn when I talk to someone that can, you know, has completely different views, and we can have a conversation, and maybe neither of us change our minds, but we don't hate each other and we haven't said things we're going to regret. I mean, I have tons of friends that have very different political views. I mean, I'm really happy to say that. And we can have a conversation, and we haven't gotten to the point where we've called each other names or, you know, said, I don't, you know, and kick me off Facebook or whatever it is. I think that civil discourse is truly, truly important. And I think, unfortunately, we've kind of lost the art of civil discourse. So I really appreciate what you're doing, because I think you're trying to bring that art form back. And have us, you know, remember how important that is.
Oh, thank you. We aim to do that as much as we can. Sometimes we slide to one side or another, but we try to be as friendly to all ears as we can. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for that. I would like to remind people that it is... we're recording this in the third week of October. You'll hear this in the third week of October, rather. And so there's just a couple weeks left to the election. If you have not voted and you are registered to vote, please either pick up your ballot and vote, or mail it in, or go vote on voting day, which is what I'm going to do. November 3rd, which is the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November, which I remind people is in the Constitution. Please vote, because your vote counts, not individually, but in the aggregate. Mm-hmm. In the aggregate, as we all vote, we all make group decisions. That's the awesomeness of representative democracy. So I would encourage you to, and I would encourage you to, again, we mentioned it before, but please do pull down your ballot from your elections, your state elections board, look at it ahead of time so that you can read the dense paragraphs at the bottom and have an idea of what they say, so that you can figure out who these people are, so you know who you're voting for, and you're not just voting because their name sounds cool or familiar. Although, you know what, if that's what it takes to get you in the booth, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with you doing that rather than not voting at all. So if my choice is research or not voting, I vote, do vote no matter what, because your voice does count in the aggregate, and it's important that you vote.
And most importantly, local elections, your vote does count in that, absolutely.
Yes. So. Well, that's true, because those are decided sometimes by 100 or 200 votes. Yep. I'm sorry, I should have said in the presidential realm, it's an aggregate importance, but at the local level, you're right, it is intensely important that you vote. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Richmond listener, the mayorship is up for election this year. So, and that's huge. Mm-hmm. So do please go vote. And thank you so much, Patty, for coming back. I'm glad I didn't scare you off the last time.
Not at all. This was great. Really appreciated a chance to chat about this, and lots of food for thought.
Yes. Thank you so much. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.